Margie Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Cheers, everyone. Welcome once again to the show. I am your host, as always, Marty Leeds. So glad you could join me. I've really been looking forward to the show and had a blast speaking with my guest. I try to bring as many different voices to the show as possible, and then the whole premise and impetus behind this podcast was to highlight people that have inspired me and people who I feel have a lot to bring to the table. A few weekends back, I had hiked the Pacific Crest Trail here in Oregon for a stretch, and I got home after a pretty strenuous hike, and I had a big meal, and you know, I had a few beers, and I started surfing YouTube for PCT videos, and I serendipitously came across this documentary from As It Happens TV. And tonight we're going to be speaking with one of the producers of this documentary. And hiking has been close to my heart for a very long time, and I feel that the connection with nature has been largely lost in our day and age and our civilization. I'm an avid hiker, and I deeply appreciate the wild, the natural untouched state, if you will. And I can't stress enough, and this is from years of personal experience, I can't stress enough how important that connection has been for me, and how that resonance has been, that connection and resonance with nature. I feel that one of mankind's most important challenges right now is actually to reconnect with that essence within nature and to reconnect with that source. And it is mainly the topic that we're going to be talking about tonight on the show. And it's a sentiment that I just really share. So, all right, let's get to the show, shall we? Tonight's guest is documentarian Andy Laub from As It Happens TV and The Dusty Camel. And the musical guest is Durango, Colorado's D.L. Marble. This show is brought to you by The Syncbook Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts. 42 minutes, always record and synchronize. More information about Syncbook Press, Syncbook Radio, and Syncbook events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support. Our guest tonight is Andy Laub. Andy is a director, music composer, and cinematographer, and has worked for the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, the Travel Channel, Animal Planet, and Aura TV. In 2009, not yet through with college, Andy undertook the quest of hiking the Appalachian Trail solo, never having undergone a through hike before. 3 days into the journey, he met his soon-to-be friend, confidant, and hiking partner, Ian Mangiardi. Together, they hiked the entirety of the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine, a 2,160-mile trek. After sharing the experience, they decided to continue the quest and in 2011 undertook hiking the Pacific Crest Trail and produced a documentary about the adventure. Andy currently helps run the Dusty Camel and As It Happens TV, organizations dedicated to protecting and conserving nature and enlivening the spirit of the outdoors within us all. So without further ado, let's get pious with Andy Laub. Andy, welcome to the show. What has happened to man? So good you could join me.
Thank you for having me, man. I'm here in Boston and excited to chat.
Do you want to introduce yourself to the audience a little bit? Tell everybody what you do, about your organizations and things like that?
Sure. My name's Andy Laub. I'm the founder and director of As It Happens TV. I'm also the co-founder of The Dusty Camel. I am a director and producer in nonfiction, mostly documentary TV and film. And As It Happens TV is my production house, and the Dusty Camel is a free guiding consulting firm that I started with my good friend and hiking buddy Ian Mangiardi. So that helps people get out there, and my films through As It Happens TV inspire people to get out there. So that's my deal.
So you lead teams to go out in different places, like all over the country or all over the world, or?
Well, our work through the Dusty Camel has helped everybody, everybody from many different corners of the earth, mainly get on thru hikes here in the United States. So what we do is we help people, whether it's achieving pro deals with those really expensive but high quality outdoor companies. We also basically, sometimes all it is just a very long conversation to kind of tackle any scary things about the trails that they don't really know. Taking on a multi-thousand mile hike can be pretty daunting to somebody who's never done it. So we can kind of help them get over those speed bumps. We help them along the way. We'll host their blog for them. But basically anything that we can do to help them get out on basically long trails, mainly in the US. We've also done things in Mongolia and all over the place. But anything that we can do through the Dusty Camel, we do, and yeah, that's mainly the service for the Dusty Camel is getting people out there through a lot of consulting and free consulting. So,
So is this like a full-time job for you guys then?
no, actually, Ian and I we both do very somewhat different but similar things. Ian is actually a guide in Bhutan. He works for a company called the King's Challenge, and it's a very exclusive but very cool guided trip through Bhutan, which is a very sealed off section of the world. Absolutely beautiful. I'm very jealous of his work over there. And I work in television and also independent media. So, As It Happens TV, I try to keep that content free and on my YouTube channel at asithappens.tv on YouTube. And that is mostly long journey films, anything that inspires people to get out into nature or shifts perspectives on nature. And then outside of As It Happens TV, I've also worked for National Geographic, Discovery Channel, Travel. You name the nonfiction network, I've probably done a series or worked with them in some capacity.
So you are an extremely busy man.
I am a freelancer. Well, it ebbs and flows, but yes, I'm usually pretty busy. So
So what's on your plate right now?
right now, actually, I'm working on a film about the first little person to ever run the Boston Marathon. Very cool story about this amazing woman named Julie Windsor. She tried to do it in 2013, and of course, there was the bombings here in Boston, so she was not able to finish. So the story is this beautiful window into Boston, the year between 2013 and her attempt in 2014, to become the first little person to run Boston. So it's a really, really cool feature film, that we are getting towards the later parts of post on. And that's one of the projects that I'm on right now that I'm excited about.
Wow, yeah, that's cool. That's very cool.
It's a bit far from the mountains, but it's still a very cool journey. So, it's exciting to be on.
Yeah, very, very analogous too, because it's all about kind of like mental strength and physical strength and that sort of thing, huh?
Yeah, I really, anytime I can have the chance to dive into a film that deals with the highs and lows of a journey, I think those bring out some of the best stories, especially a long journey. Hence why the As It Happens Pacific Crest is a film about a journey from Mexico to Canada. But it's just the stories that can come out, like in this film about Julie and also in the Pacific Crest, they're very deep and they're very layered, and that excites me as a filmmaker and a storyteller.
Yeah. Do you want to give the audience a little background as to like how you met Ian and how you got going on this film originally?
Sure. So Ian and I, in the winter of 2009, had set out separately. We did not know each other. And we were setting out on the Appalachian Trail. Now, I grew
Which
up,
is beautiful, by the way.
which is beautiful, but
Oh,
we
it's
were setting
amazing.
out
Yeah.
in the first week of February. So there was actually nobody else out there when we were both setting out again separately. So I took a 19-hour Greyhound bus from Philadelphia, where I grew up. And I've never backpacked a day in my life. I had done a lot of car camping, and I thought that would equate to like mountain experience, but I was very, very wrong. So I set out a 19-hour bus ride, and I got to Atlanta, and I hopped out of the bus, and I was picturing, okay, well, it's February, but when I get to Georgia, it's going to be warm. Well, I got to Atlanta, hopped off the bus, and it was 17 degrees.
Oh, jeez.
So that right off the bat was like, oh my God. Now, I was prepared. I had my dad's 80s ski jacket. It was like all fluorescent colors and really funny and like probably about 12 pounds. So I caught a ride up to the trailhead and I began hiking. And immediately I was like, holy, like I am not prepared for this in any way. There was snow everywhere. All the water sources, all the creeks were frozen. I was completely alone. So on the third night, I was in my shelter, you know, just very dehydrated because I couldn't get my stove to work because I had never used it before. All the water was freezing. And I was eating like cold peanut butter out of the jar. And I was just like, this is not what I had pictured it. You know, this is not, I'm going home tomorrow. I like wrote in my journal. I was like, I cannot do this. I'm going to be so embarrassed going home, but I just can't do this. And actually an interesting statistic is that 30% of all thru hikers or people that try these long haul trails in one try, 30% on the Appalachian Trail drop off on the third day.
Really?
So even though I wasn't starting in the pack, I was still experiencing that kind of third day kind of hump. And I said I was going to go home. So the next day I got up and it was a beautiful sunny day. It was still cold, but it was more bearable. And I was like, you know what? Like, I have to at least do something here. Maybe I can get to like, you know, the North Carolina border. So I can say I walked, you know, Georgia, which isn't actually that far. And that night, that fourth day, that night is when I actually shared a camp with Ian. And we met very serendipitously. He actually grew up in Manhattan. And we shared a camp that night. And I was like, you know, we were about the same age. I just kind of almost finished college. And I was like, oh, man, you hiking to Maine? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, wow. Well, you're hiking to Maine. I'm hiking to Maine. Why don't we just, like, hike together? And he had, you know, he actually had much better equipment. He knew how to use his stove. So it was like I got my first hot meal in, you know, a couple days. And it was just we hiked the whole Appalachian Trail together, to make a very long story short. And we became best buddies. And when we finished the trail, we had experienced, both of us, especially because we both had grown up in big Northeast cities, we experienced this freedom. And I say it in the film, it's a freedom that really only existed in dreams, although it was very tough. It's a very raw freedom. Those highs were so high and the lows were so low. And we had such amazing experiences in the mountains and connecting really with the most remote backcountry you can get on the East Coast. And then going from that to all of our experiences in the towns, when we went to resupply, hitchhiking, and staying at all kinds of different people's houses. By the time we were done, it was just like, it was an experience that really, I mean, belonged in a film. So we'd gotten off the trail and we went back to regular life, and I went back to working in reality television, making some good shows, some food shows, some hunting shows, but also some nuts. I almost shot the Teen Mom reunion. That was like the low of my career after the Appalachian Trail. But then I got this email from Ian, and it was like, hey man, like, what would you think about doing the Pacific Crest Trail out west? It's a trail. It's 2,600 miles from Mexico to Canada, running up California, Oregon, and Washington. And I had a pretty comfortable job at the time. I was actually working at Discovery Channel. And I wrote this really long email about all these things that were going on. And at the very end, I was just like, let's do it. Like, let's do it. But, you know, let's not just do it for us. Like, let's actually capture this and show people what this experience is like. Because we had changed so much. We went through this metamorphosis on the trail and it become much humbler. There's so many things that connecting with nature can really do to your perspective. We can talk about that later, but we wanted to make a film that inspired people to have that same connection, to have not a museum experience with nature where you drive to a parking lot and you walk out and you take a couple pictures, but to actually have an experience, a real experience inside nature, and connect with it. And so we started planning. We did a Kickstarter campaign. We made the dustycamel.org, which is the free guiding service that we talked about. And we were sponsored by Mountain Hardware. We got a grant, which was really awesome. And having no real experience with cameras or anything like that, I was just a writer in television. We set out May 2011 to hike and film an experience on America's Pacific Crest Trail.
Oh, wow. How long was this planning process? Was it basically a year since you did the Appalachian? I mean, how old were you when you went on the Appalachian Trail?
I was 21. I turned 22 on the Appalachian, and that the
day so you were like spry, huh?
I was a baby, man. I actually I don't care if this airs. I was in Emerson College at the time, and I had worked really hard. I did a lot of extra credits because I was trying to graduate early to save money. And I had made it so my last semester, all I had to do was an independent study. So what I did was I did all the work for the independent study in the fall so that I had the whole spring semester off. So starting in January, end of January, I had until graduation off. So I was like, all right, I'm going to hike the Appalachian Trail in this, you know, this kind of grace period before I need to start my career and start life and everything. And at the time I was working in news. So when I left for the Appalachian Trail, I was still technically enrolled full time at college. And then when graduation rolled around, we were still on the trail. We were up in New Hampshire, and we actually hitchhiked down to Boston for my graduation. So that was really funny. But yeah, I was very young. I was only 21, 22. And then it took another 2 years. No, yes, I believe it was 2 years in 2000. Yeah, two years to get out on the Pacific Crest. So I was 24 going on 25 at the time of hiking the Pacific Crest Trail.
And this came out, the video came out in 2011, you said? What is that?
No, actually. Well, there was the actual hike in 2011. We left May 5th, 2011. And then it was a 173-day journey. It was a very, very long trip. It was almost the full 6 months. The film's speaks, you know, a lot to that journey. But yeah, it was 6 months. And then the film didn't come out until actually this May is when I finally released it. I had showed it a few times in New York City and elsewhere, also in California. But it was actually released this May 2014. So.
Oh, right. What were the preparations like for this? I mean, I know you guys got help online. You guys did a Kickstarter and things like that. But how much did this cost you and all of that sort of thing?
Yeah. So we had a $5,000 grant from Mountain Hardware, and that paid for we had one camera. It was a Canon Rebel. It's a very easy to use DSLR. I recommend it to anyone who's just getting into photography and wants to take it up a notch from your standard point and shoots. It's very easy to use, and it was very cheap. It's only like $500 compared to some other DSLRs. But that grant mainly paid for production equipment. We had all of our gear donated by sponsors, sponsors like Nemo, Icebreaker, Merino Wool. They had all of our base layers. Mountain Hardware supplied us with all of our jackets and most of our clothing. We were sponsored by Gregory Backpacks, but all of our gear was sponsored. So when we actually got down to it, the only thing that we were paying for when we were out there was food and college loans. So we can't escape those, even in the middle of nowhere. So really we're just paying for food. So they say to factor about $1 or $2 a mile. So it's good to have like about at least, I would say, to do it comfortably, $3,500 to $4,000 to do the Pacific Crest. Mm-hmm. Just for in cases of emergency where you need to dry out in a town or you have to wait for a package or, you know, shipping costs of things like that. You learn a lot about the mail system when you do these long trails. Again, it was probably about maybe $3,500 or $4,000 for each of us to go out and for a 6 month trip. So.
So yeah, you had all this like pretty nice gear. I mean, I remember like saying you had like a, I think your actual tent had like a solar panel on it, so you could charge everything. When you set out this time, did you know how to work any of that shit? Like, did you, well, or did you just like figure it out as you went along? You know,
we kind of figured it out as we went along. We did have a what's called a solar roll. It's a 6 foot roll out by Brunton, and that we could pull right into the tent. And in the desert, it worked like a charm. High Sierras, it worked great. And that charged. We had an iPad with us. Because gear is so light, it's actually really easy to be able to carry these kinds of extra little things. But yeah, at the time, I still had not really worked a camera. So this 6 month trip was going to be my all intensive workshop on how to work a camera. And that was really. That was the most rewarding thing out of my experience on the Pacific Crest was actually I fell absolutely in love with cameras. And now it's very rare that I make a trip or do really anything without a camera by my side. So
was your, I mean, what got you out there originally? Was your family like the outdoorsy type, or did you have this sort of like, you know, I mean, you were saying that you kind of had this like romantic idea of what it would be like on the trail. And then you get 3 days in, you're like, oh geez, you know, what drew you out there? What brought you out there?
Yeah, that question of why is a very hard thing to tackle. It's somewhat complex, but I can only give it to the circumstance of what brought me to the Appalachian. I had just finished covering the 2008 presidential election. It was pretty grinding. It was pretty grueling. I was on the road for weeks at a time, and it was that exhaustion mixed with this kind of. It was a feeling that a lot of people had in 2008 where they just wanted a big change. I mean, that's why Obama's slogan at the time was so powerful, was this big change. And I had always lived in the cities, but I always had this notion and found peace when I went out for very short stints in nature or in state parks or anything like that. So I decided that I had put myself through college and it was kind of now or never if I was going to try to experience that kind of serenity, that kind of connection with nature I'd always dreamed of and never really knew what it meant, but there was always a longing for it. I mean, it's cliche, but the call of the wild is something that I think all of us have, but it's whether we actually listen to it and recognize it. Mm-hmm. And there was this window that I had created for myself in this spring semester of college. And like I said, I just finished covering the campaign and was just finishing with all my school. And I was like, you know what, this is the time. And that's, you know, it was the time to go. It was probably not the right time because it was winter. you know, it was really that call of the wild that I felt and that I think a lot of us feel. And now that I've experienced that, I hate to say the word addicting, but once you experience that kind of connection, it really changes you forever. That's why we went back.
Yeah, so. It is really addicting. I mean, yeah. even when I'm a pretty avid hiker myself, even if I go and have a bad hike, I'll still like, I mean, just, there was just a couple weekends ago, I went to this hike, it was like a 14, 15 mile hike and it just wasn't that good. And the, you know, the summit wasn't that great, anything like that. And I get down and I'm driving home and I'm thinking, all right, what am I going to do next weekend? You know?
Yeah, exactly, man. It's you're kind of always, I don't use the word addicting because I think it's something deeper than that. I think it's actually something innate that's inside of us. All your senses become alive. You're suddenly using your nose. You're using your ears. You're really using your eyes, your skin. You're trying to feel the weather patterns. I mean, it sounds a little funny outside of it, but when you're that exposed and that remote for so long, it really awakens something inside of you and it makes you feel alive. And like you just said, the lows, like, you know, you might have a crappy day with really rough weather, but then you have this magnificent golden hour or sunset that's mixed with these beautiful clouds and suddenly the sky is illuminated in these salmon pinks. And it gives me chills even just thinking about it. But that's those highs and lows and those experiences in real nature and backcountry, you can't let it go. It stays with you.
Yeah. I mean, it elevates the spirit. I mean, to me, it's a very spiritual experience, right?
Yeah, and that's something it does factor into the film later on
quite a bit. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, big time. I think when I say shifting perspectives, and my perspective has definitely been shifted many times, and I believe it will be shifted many times again. But spirituality, I don't go to church, but I consider myself to be relatively spiritual in this cycle, in this sense that there's something larger going on that I can't fully fathom. But when you're standing inside, like for instance, the Bowl of Whitney, when we went and summited Mount Whitney on the summer solstice, and inside the bowl at about the underside of Whitney at about 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and I just looked up, and there's nothing that man has made that has impressed me like that morning inside of there. In the film, I think the line that I wrote was, it was like a brushstroke painted over time or something like that. But it's this immensity that just humbles you, but it also empowers you. It's this interesting kind of paradox. And it is the most spiritual experience I've ever had, or moments like that, standing next to a 3,000-foot granite wall.
And in the film, I mean, because you guys climbed Mount Whitney, and it was like one of the worst winters ever, right?
Yeah, we actually. So all right, so the Appalachian Trail, we had actually hiked through the coldest winter the South had seen in 50 years. And then when we went to hike the Pacific Crest Trail in 2011, it was the harshest winter the High Sierras had had, and the whole West Coast had had in about 50 years, or even in a century, I think. It was nuts. I mean, it was the High Sierras, which make up about 500 miles of the Pacific Crest Trail. They were completely and utterly snowed in. There was no dirt for those 500 miles, a massive avalanche areas, and avalanche debris from earlier in the spring, just obscure. It was a lot of navigation that was GPS or, using our topo maps. It was wild. And not to mention all of the most scary and acute danger that we faced on the whole trail was really the rivers. I mean, when they say God willing and the creek don't rise, I'll make it home, before it was that feeling. And, that actually, you want to talk about highs and lows. I was just describing the high and the bowl inside Mount Whitney and that feeling. And then even when we got up to the top, we got stark naked because it was the summer solstice. But that was a high, but a low would be, in one of those High Sierra streams with the water just flowing so fast, so cold from all the snow melt, just ripping around your body. And you can literally feel your poles shaking and your feet just creeping back a little bit, and just knowing that people were dying around us. It was the deadliest year in Yosemite's history. And just knowing that if you slipped, you would be ripped downstream and most likely drown or be very seriously injured. It was intense. It was very intense.
You're bringing up a really good point here. Like when you climbed Mount Whitney, there was that point where you said, I think, or Ian said, he looked up and he's like, okay, hey, we're going up there, and it's just full of snow. And it's just like, I mean, if there was no snow, that would be a tough climb. And then but you made it up there, and then you tried to do Shasta along the way, and you didn't get up there. Like when do you know when it's like, okay, I need to turn around. I can't, it's like some people want that summit push because they want to make it to the top, but then you have to have that intuition and be smart enough about it to say, no, I need to, be smart about this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's, it's a good question. Shasta, because it was not on our trail, it was actually a detour to go and actually hike Shasta. That's the one thing about through hiking that is so addicting. Your life is so full of purpose because you have to get to Canada, right? You have to get to Canada. So the thing that drove us through the High Sierras and through some very perilous terrain because of the snow was there's no other option. This is the path that has been laid out, and this is the path that we're going to walk. When we got to Mount Shasta, it was... we had got hit by a really a freak storm that wasn't on the radar, and because of that, we're seriously delayed. And then the snow that they was still on the mountain at the time, we didn't have any crampons or ice axes or anything. We hit a point where it was very late in the afternoon. We hadn't hit anywhere close to the summit yet, and it was just time to descend before getting stuck up there at night. But the driving force behind a lot of the terrain that we went through, especially towards the end of the trail when we got close to Canada, was just there's no other option. I mean, that's I think part of what brings you back to nature. It's like you just have to do it. There's no other option. It's sort of like a migration almost. And you just have to get to that point, that finish.
Yeah, I mean, to me, like modern civilization, it feels like this is the one major thing that we are lacking is this direct connection with nature. And you, I mean, I think one your mission statement is even to inspire people to go outdoors, and then the more that they do this, the more they will be inspired to protect it. And
And what I mean by that, more specifically, is if we can inspire people to go and have a real experience, a real connection with nature, then there will be a certain level of respect there. So, and then in daily life, and that translates into everything from, how much you recycle to if you're a politician, the decisions you make in the cabinet or in Congress. I mean, anybody and everybody has a direct effect on nature, and the decisions we make every day reflect that. So if you have a deep experience with nature and you truly and authentically respect it, it'll be reflected in the decisions and everything within our society, within American life.
Yeah, we could use some more politicians getting out in the nature,
Yes, we really could. Teddy Roosevelt went out and made the national parks with John Muir, so maybe I can get the next president to come out on a thru hike. I don't
Yeah, I mean, we have. I mean, that's the thing that I think a lot of people forget about the United States here is that we have one of the best national park systems. I mean, there is just so many amazing places in this country to go and explore. How many have you? Where else have you explored in the United States?
know. Well, actually, last summer I was on a series called Wayward Nation, and we traveled 20,000 miles all around the U.S. for this series. It's premiering now. I'm going to plug it because a new episode just came out tonight. It's aura.tv/waywardnation, and there's 12 episodes. We were in Moab, at the Arches. We were down in Texas. We were in Maine. I mean, we went. There was an episode, there was 12 episodes, but we traveled all over the US, Shiprock, New Mexico, which is this beautiful monolith in the middle of this desert flat. But there, I mean, that's one of the things about the Pacific Crest, the As It Happens Pacific Crest Trail, is what I realized was that, and it's sort of a spoiler here. It's sort of the last line of the film, but that a journey through the back of this country really captures what it's all about. And that's both in the land, the immensity, and the kind of stories that can come out of that kind of journey. But yeah, there is so much in the United States. It's amazing. People always say, because I travel a lot for work, and I go out of the country, and they'll be like, "Oh, where should we go for X, Y, and Z to have a really great adventure?" And I live in Boston, and I just tell them, "Well, just go up to New Hampshire, go up to the Whites, go to Vermont, go out to the Berkshires, go down to the Connecticut River." I mean, there's so much beauty in the United States, and it's so diverse. It's amazing. It's amazing
Yeah.
diversity in this country. People just really need to get out there and connect with it.
Yeah, and the diversity on the Pacific Crest Trail is pretty insane. Like you were even talking about when Mount Whitney, you were at, you're covered in snow, and then you're walking down, and then you're in mud, and all of
Oh
this.
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Pacific Crest, that's one thing that's really unique. A lot of people ask the difference between the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest. And the Pacific Crest has five really distinct regions. You have the Mojave Desert, which is this what I thought was going to be this very arid. Actually, it's very arid right now because of the drought out there, but just beautiful. If you go through there, the Mojave Desert in full spring bloom, I mean, it's like a rainbow. There's just so much color out there with all the cactus flowers and everything else. High Sierras, it's just this beautiful granite mountains that are, and when we went through them, were just covered in white, but just beautiful lakes and everything else. Northern California is volcanic, and the mountains are very different looking. lots more forest up in Northern California. Oregon is beautiful. It's more of a rolling forest, rolling mountains. And then you get to Washington, which for me is my favorite, because the Northern Cascades are almost like the Dolomites, where they're these very spindly ridges. And when you have some fresh winter snow on them, they just look, I mean, just, it's the most crisp, it's the definition of crisp, crisp landscape. It's the diversity on out west is just, it's jaw-dropping, it's eye-opening.
Yeah, yeah, I fell in love with the West at a pretty early age just because of all the diversity, you know, it's like really,
You're out in Eugene, right? You're in Oregon?
Yeah, I'm in Eugene, and I mean, I literally, you know, pretty much every weekend, it's like I can drive 2 or 3 hours and see all of this, whether it's, you know, the Cascade Range or the ocean or going up to Hood, and it's like you really, you know, it's just so beautiful out here, and it's unfortunate. I a lot of my friends, a lot of people that hang out with don't go to this stuff ever. It's like, really, Crater Lake is just like 3 hours that way, man, you know? it's pretty insane that more people don't take advantage of this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's part of the mission. That's part of my life mission, is really to change people's perspective on nature and just get them out there into it. I think it'll make people happier, and you know, that has all kinds of repercussions when you have happier people. So
yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, just a snowball effect. When you undergo like an extending hiking adventure like the one you underwent, it not only attests like your physical body, but also like the, you know, the fortitude of your mind. Do you feel that there's something about pushing yourself in all aspects that allows like this wholeness of self, or allows like the best of you to come through? Do you know what I mean? Like something about pushing all aspects of you unearths this latent potential or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The best way to answer that is I'm a runner. I'm a long distance runner. I've run 2 Boston marathons. I ran last year with my fiance. And
what was your time?
It was pretty bad, actually. She beat me. I don't want to say it on this radio.
Oh, that's cool.
She's awesome. I took on long distance hiking out of that long distance running kind of mentality. I thought it was just going to be a physical challenge at first. And but then, you know, once I got into long distance hiking, I realized how much of a mental game it is. Just like running, actually, is running is mainly mental as well. And long distance hiking is different though, because it is so long. I mean, it is, you know, 6 months of doing the same thing. And I would say that it does bring out the best, but it also brings out the worst. I think you have to really, you have this solitude, this time to really face yourself, face what's good about you, face what's bad about you. I think that's what creates the metamorphosis, throughout these long journeys that I think a lot of people want in life. I think, it's not easy, to have that kind of time to really reflect on your life to that point and what you want going forward. But it's raw, it's there. I mean, it's just, imagine if you could imagine 8 to 12 hours a day of just, you know, pretty quiet. You run out of conversations after maybe the first month. So it's relatively,
it's like, dude,
quiet.
I've heard that story before, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, I could tell all of Ian's stories just like he could tell mine. I mean, you know, it's just like, but yeah, when you really face yourself, I mean, that's what these hikes really allow you to do. You find out so many things about yourself that you didn't really realize. And I think that is part of what ultimately changes you on these trips. And you don't realize it at first. You don't realize it till you get back home and you're in these kind of normal situations, whether you're, you know, for me, I used to be a really fast driver. I used to have a crazy temper. I had all kinds of issues with the police. I mean, I could go on. I got in all kinds of fights. It was, and now if I were to tell you that, and you would never believe it. I drive like a grandmom now in the right lane. I'm strongly against any kind of violence. I don't have a temper unless, like, tonight I ruined the pizza. I was a little pissed at that, but I was making pizza. But yeah, I mean, it's that time to face yourself, I think, is really special on the through hikes. And I think it's what people long for. I think it's part of the reason why people go out there, is to kind of find out who you are. And these hikes give you the space to do that.
Yeah, I'm really glad you're saying that, because to me, for me, it's like I've never really been like a habitual meditator or anything like that. I mean, I've done like sensory deprivation tanks and things like that, but to me, the most like meditative or contemplative state I've ever been in is those hikes, and that's where I get every time, and I really enjoy that now. And to me, it's almost like my own form of meditation. Is that how you kind of see it?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's funny you say meditation because later in the film, we, as you saw, we stayed in a Buddhist monastery nestled up in the mountains in Washington, and I had never actually thought of it like that until that point, and it was so late in the journey, and then it kind of all kind of came full circle after staying at that monastery. We were kind of waiting out a storm, and we had actually, you know, went through the whole ritual of meditating formally. And after that, it was interesting. Things really changed for us. But walking meditation, you know, it sounds maybe a little hippy-dippy, kind of lefty, but
sure.
all it is just, you know, kind of being quiet and kind of listening to this internal conversation that's kind of going on in your head and making sense of it and kind of critically thinking. And it's a special thing. I promote it a lot. People should do it.
Yeah. This this desire and like deep yearning to be in the wild is, as you were saying, is well, it's prevalent in you, but it's a lot of people miss that. I mean, it's dead in others. Why do you feel like it's been lost, if you will, or that it's dead in others, or that people don't have that drive or connection to get that or draw it out of themselves, if you will?
The only thing I can compare it to is a Louis C.K. joke. So I'm crediting Louis C.K. on this, but you know, he had a joke where he said, you know, I give my kid an apple and they just look at it and toss it away and I can't figure out why are they not eating this apple. And really what's happening is they're going out and eating a Snickers, you know, the day before, you know, earlier that day. So when they get to the apple just tastes like mushy shit. Like it doesn't have any flavor. Well, I think that's sort of a metaphor that you could use for experiences in life. I mean, society has so much, there's so much being thrown at us. There's so much instantaneous kind of gratification, whether it's online media or whether it's, social networks or whether it's even just going to a bar on a Friday night and, you know, getting really drunk and having a good time. You know, everything's very instant. But so when you get to nature, because it does kind of take a little bit longer to find these longer kind of satisfactions and actually experience the wild, you know, answer that call, it takes longer.
It requires patience, right?
It requires patience. It also requires, you know, a certain sense of observation where, you know, you may not really realize it until you get done, you know? So I think it's because it's not as apparent, it's not as instantaneous, and it's not really promoted all that well either. I mean, we live in four walls. I mean, being outside is like a chance occurrence for us. So I think all those kind of factor into why people don't either hear the call or maybe they don't answer it or they're not curious about it. But the call of the wild, I think it's there. It's just... you know, I hate to say it's getting harder to answer it, but I think there's more things getting in the way of getting people out to those experiences, especially misperceptions about nature too. You know, the number one question we get in towns is like, oh my God, you know, what do you guys do when you see a bear? You know, it's like, what do you do when you see a bear? It's like always the number one question. People are so petrified of bears. And I can tell you the only time I've seen bears is their ass because they're running away. So like, you know, but it's just these misperceptions and a very different kind of gratification that you get in society and civilization. It's just different, and I think people are scared of that. I think they're really scared of that, and they're not willing to explore it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you're talking about gratification. It seems like there's, you know, you were talking earlier about the fact that it's like, oh, I used to be this crazy driver and be more aggressive. And then I went out and did this and it sort of, you know, cured a lot of that stuff. And I think that a lot of people have this sort of like low self-esteem or like depressive thing in them. And it's almost like, hey man, if you went and did this, you might cure some of that. And that, I think that that message really needs to be pushed. And I'm really glad that you're doing that because it's very important for me.
Definitely, man. Actually, to even be more proactive about it, my fiance, she's a kids doctor here in Boston, and she is part of working with the AMC for this thing called Prescription for the Outdoors, which basically gives doctors a notepad, a prescription pad for the outdoors. And they have to get essentially it's a systematic kind of thing to get people out in the parks. I worked with an organization down in New York City called Discover Outdoors Foundation, which works with New York City public schools to get the schools partnered with state and national parks so that the parks are getting more numbers. They're getting people into the parks. And then these kids who are otherwise kind of isolated in New York City in Manhattan or Brooklyn or the Bronx, and it gets them up and out into nature, and it kind of bridges that gap. It bridges that, it gives them a little taste of it. There's programs out there that are trying to, you know, reverse any of these, what's happening, the trends, to stay away from nature. So.
Yeah, that's awesome. When you were out there for that extended time, was there points where you got pretty depressed? I mean, were there points where you're like, all right, screw this, I'm out of here. I'm going to go to a beach and sip a margarita and take a shower, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny. With the Pacific Crest, because it was interesting, because for me, there wasn't just a hike happening. It was like me trying to document the hike too. And because I had the camera, suddenly there was this whole other, I don't want to say agenda because that has a bad connotation, but there was a whole nother mission besides getting to Canada. It was capturing the experience. And I had the camera at my hip the entire time. And I said it in the beginning of the program, but I had never worked with a camera before. But by the end, I was so excited about every day because it was a photo opportunity. It was an opportunity to capture this just everything suddenly became, whether it was a Sierra snowflower, which is the rarest flower in North America. It's only out for a very small amount of time, or, these massive landscapes or really amazing portraits of kind of everyday people. It became this opportunity to really explore even deeper. I can honestly say that I never hit any kind of depression or anything like that. When it came to actually being out there, I think the lull that I would have felt was erased by my just passion for photography and passion for capturing the world around me, this very unique and remote place.
So it never got like cumbersome to like try to film everything, right? Because I mean, it's obviously you're doing what, 20, 26 miles a day or whatever. And it's like, okay, I got to stop and I got to set up the camera and I got to do that. You know, that never really hit you or anything, or it just became just fun to do.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like there's one scene where it's literally we had in Northern Washington, it was just whiteout after whiteout. We just got hit with a string of really bad snowstorms. Winter had come and we were caught really kind of off guard. And, one of the shots, I remember, it was literally like a ping pong ball. It was like walking without dimension into just like white abyss. And I remember I was like, oh man, this sucks so bad, but like, I need to set up this shot. So like, you know, I put down and get the little tripod out and I stick the camera down in the snow, make sure the focus is good. And, you know, and then you see me walking out and then you see me walking back just to make sure I got the shot. And it's a really compelling shot because it's the snow is like up to my thigh and it's just white. I mean, it's an amazing shot, but you know, that was maybe not so fun to get.
You're glad you got it though, right?
But I'm happy it's how I captured it. But you know, I think a camera, and this is one thing that I'm just starting to do photography workshops that I like to get across, is that a camera really opens up your eye. I mean, it makes you look at things in a different way. It makes you look at the not just the big landscapes, but all the small things around you, the macro. I mean, that kind of changes your perspective, just like a through hike can, or a long journey, because suddenly you're looking at the world and you're seeing this detail in small things that you didn't notice before. And it's amazing. And it really shows. I mean, for me, when I watch the film, the beginning is good, but by the end, it's much better. It's much stronger because I had more time with the camera and more time to practice.
Uh-huh. So you were saying that you didn't get depressed, but I think I remember there was a point in the film where Ian had got kind of, got kind of depressed and you guys kind of a little falling out or whatever. And I think it was during the time that you guys were in like the burnt forest of Oregon, like, which is like extremely like desolate. And you know that, I mean, certain areas take on certain personalities. And I mean, do you feel like you sort of absorb those characteristics, or people can absorb those characteristics from that?
Yeah,
those different landscapes, if you will.
Sure. I mean, what Ian was facing was basically the kind of, all right, I want to get this done as quickly as possible and get back to my girlfriend, you know, in New York City. Mm-hmm. And And it really hit because we had to pick up the miles in Oregon because we knew winter was coming. We knew it was coming. So we were going faster. We averaged 27 miles a day.
That's crazy.
Every day for 3 weeks straight. So I think we had one day off in that whole thing for a bigger resupply. But, you know, you can only imagine that kind of physical and mental exhaustion. And just knowing that even after you finish those 3 weeks, you still have another 500 miles to walk. That was a burn. It was a big, there was a lot of burn in Oregon. And it's very trippy. It's very weird. Because everything, and I said it in the film, there was this kind of this like weird, weird is not the right word, but there was a paradox because there was all this, you could see, you know, the visual burn trees for, you know, dozens of miles. But then you see all this new life kind of forming underneath and you see the cycle. It's most present in that kind of contrast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of dead old life and all this new life that's thriving on top of it. And, every different, you know, each of the five different terrains that we went through, it was a different style of hiking for each, for sure. I mean, the High Sierras was a light mountaineering experience. We didn't have ropes or anything, but crampons. And the desert was very swift, wait out the afternoons and try to hike more miles at night. Washington was winter, so it was actually cold winter hiking. Each terrain took on a whole different hiking style and mentality.
So in Oregon, was there any specific points that you really dug that you remember?
Oh, man, I loved all of Oregon. Oregon, I having hiked up the Appalachian and the Pacific Crest, Oregon was my favorite. The mountains were beautiful, but as far as the towns go, it was my favorite state for towns by far. Oh, man, Bend, Ashland was beautiful. You know, I say this a lot, but when we would go in for resupplies, and this is something we haven't really touched on, but we hitchhike into towns. Mm-hmm. And it's always this kind of visceral thing to go from this really quiet, remote wilderness and then to hitchhike into a town, and suddenly you're confronted with all this, you know, hubbub and everything you expect in normal life, but it's even more visceral coming from the backcountry. But Oregon was great because every time I went into a town, everybody was kind of somewhat on that wavelength. It was less of a harsh, reaction coming into town. But yeah.
So yeah, hitchhiking. This is interesting because a lot of people have a lot of aversion to hitchhiking. You had to rely on strangers for things along the way, like rides into towns and all of that. I think they're called trail angels too. Is that what they're called? How does it feel to put yourself in the hands of someone else? I mean, obviously you're a motivated guy. You get a lot of stuff done on your own. You're very active. But you put yourself in this position where it's like, shit, man, if I don't get somebody to pick me up, I'm going to be walking 60 miles back to the trail. What is that experience like?
Yeah, it's, I call it, and I try to explain this to people I work with in television, but when you don't have a parachute, when there is absolutely no parachute, the whole dynamic of the experience and of the story that's happening changes. We had went from the High Sierra to celebrate the 4th of July and hitchhiked across California way off the trail to Santa Cruz, which was like a 350-mile hitchhike, and then 350 miles to get back. So massive, massive hitchhike. And, you know, we're in the middle of the Central Valley, like by Modesto, shooting west to get to the beach. And it was just like, holy shit, man, like we are so far from the mountains. And, like, people probably just think we're bums, you know, but we when you leave yourself without a parachute, it's amazing what can happen and what kind of stories can unfold. Hitchhikes have led to so many great experiences. And to not be vague, to be a little more specific, in Massachusetts, we stayed with a hedge fund manager, and we stayed in his guest house, and his family and his, you know, they cooked a nice dinner. We actually stayed there for 2 days. In the Mojave Desert, just before the High Sierras, we stayed at an ex-convict's house, and we slept out on their back trampoline, and they made us breakfast from the chickens in their yard. You know, it's like, and every experience, every type of people and place you could imagine in between, from pot growers in Northern California to, you name it, a guy in what was it? I think Vermont, who had just lost his wife, and he was definitely a little sad. You just find these amazing stories. We crashed a family reunion in Northern California. I mean, just from a journalist perspective, which is what I consider myself, it's just amazing what you can stumble upon in hitchhiking. It's so taboo. I call it the lost American art. And it's truly an art, and I can say this with authority, having a couple thousand miles of hitchhiking under my belt. I've never had a bad experience hitchhiking, and I've only found some of the best stories. It's really cool. I mean, it's really cool. Everybody should try it.
It's really great that you're saying that, because pretty much everyone I know that hitchhikes says the same thing. People are like, "Oh, I'm gonna get murdered or raped or something." It's like, and then yet you meet some of the greatest people that you've ever met, because they're—I mean, these are genuine people that are willing to just pick up somebody who's probably smells like hell, and you really realize that there's a deep humanity there.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I don't, that I want to get across too with these hikes is, that you're deeply connecting with nature because you're throwing yourself at the whim of other people's kindness. It gives you a better sense of humanity and this kind of sense that we are all innately good, and the bad that's basically in a lot of the media and just out there in general, the stereotypes and prejudices, they really, I don't know, from my experience, they really don't exist. The day I got home from the Appalachian Trail, I actually got a tattoo. I had no tattoos. I got a tattoo on the side of my body, and it's the First Amendment to the UN Human Rights Constitution. So, if you could imagine that I had just been in remote wilderness for 5 months and I get a tattoo about humanity on the side of my body, about this innate brotherhood that we all have. And yeah, it's amazing. That's another reason why I really like to inspire people to get out and do these kind of long hikes and have these kinds of experiences.
Do you think that the natives are like the aboriginals that, were on this continent before, the white man came over or whatever? Do you feel like that was something that was just so rich in their lives that allowed them to sort of, live with one another for as long as they did? Do you know what I'm asking?
It's funny you should ask. I mean, this is something I think is interesting. And in the Native American languages, there's no word for loneliness or alone. And it's because that you're always surrounded by something. I mean, nature is something. It's a presence. It's a force. And the reason that they really didn't like us, white people in the houses and our culture and like kind of the white picket fence is because we were kind of blocking out that presence of nature. And I think that is that sticks with me, and I think it deeply influences their traditions and their culture. And it's something that, I mean, I'm talking to you from the fine metropolitan of Boston, but it's something I think that is interesting. But we do, the Western world really blocks out nature for a majority of our lives.
With that connection with nature, when you're out there so long, was it hard to reintegrate back into the culture once you were done?
It was and it wasn't. It was because I actually, when I got back to New York, I was penniless. We were both broke. We were both absolutely broke. We got back at different times, and I had landed in Manhattan, and I had really no money. And yeah, that was really tough, just from a personal point of view, but also just from coming from this amazing high of having walked across the continent, and then to being just like what looked like a bum with a backpack in New York City, trying to get my feet back. But really, what I think helped me transition and really what made some of the changes stick, really stick, because I had changed on the Appalachian Trail, but the Pacific Crest really changed me. And I think it's because I made the film. I had taken so long to actually absorb and read through the journals and look at the pictures and look at the footage and try to craft a piece that put together this, what seemed like a random journey. And I think by putting it together and me realizing, really realizing these kind of pivotal moments, these specific moments of change, whether it's change in the land or change in us or change in how we were hiking or change in how we treated each other or change in what we were even thinking about or talking about. These little differences I noticed, and when I was making the film, and I think that really helped. I think it was almost therapeutic. It was difficult to put the film together, but it was almost therapeutic, and really, I think, made the changes permanent, more permanent for me going forward. It's why I'm doing the work I'm doing now.
Yeah, undergoing something like that, did you feel like, all right, now I can do anything? You know, I underwent something that was that difficult. I saw such ebbs and flows and highs and lows that now it's like, bring it on, life, if you will.
Yes. I mean, initially from the trail, yes, for sure. I mean, and then the taking on cutting a feature film by myself, that definitely blunted that sentiment. It was like, holy shit. I mean, scoring the soundtrack. I wrote about 25 songs for the soundtrack.
Okay. You're a musician. I didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you play?
My main instrument is guitar. I play a little bit of everything. All the music you hear in the film is mine.
Wow. I didn't know that. Okay. Interesting. Great.
Yeah, outside of a few songs by some very good friends of mine, and actually my uncle does one of the songs, but I wrote about 25 songs for it. The writing of the narration, you know, taking all the photographs and making them move in like a 3D fashion, I had very high confidence before going into making the film, and then it definitely, I would say, was actually harder than the hike itself, and it humbled me yet again. But I think it's definitely made me a better storyteller and better at what I do, for sure.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, you know, like I said, it's a great film. We've only got like just a few minutes left here, but
sure.
What's next for you? Where are you headed now? What's on your plate in the next few years? Do you have that planned, or are you just kind of taking it as it comes?
Well, I have a couple of projects. I would definitely like to take As It Happens and As It Happens TV. I have a project that's it's sort of in very preliminary, but it's supported by the Clinton Global Initiative, and it's out on the Navajo and Hopi lands out in Arizona and Utah. Mm-hmm. And that is a project that I may make a feature film on. There's a very good chance of me making a feature film about this Clinton Global Initiative supported project that's happening out there. And I'm going to be embedded in the reservations for 4 months. So that is potentially going to be the next project. Then there's also, of course, completing the Triple Crown and going out and doing the Continental Divide, which is definitely on my radar. But I plan on making at least one feature film every 2 to 3 years. And whether that is a long journey film or whether it's a film like this one with the Clinton Global Initiative that is changing perspectives on nature and lifestyle, this is what I plan on doing for the rest of my life. So yeah, I'm going to be making a lot of films.
Well, it's great work, man. Like I said, I really love what you do. Do you want to tell people where they can get a hold of you, where they can support you, what, you know, that sort of thing?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. The place to go is asithappens.tv. That's the main website. You can see the Pacific Crest Trail, As It Happens Pacific Crest Trail there, and all of our digital shorts. And that's the main place to see everything that I work on. My soundtrack is also on there. You can buy it for $1 and get the whole thing. And it's really awesome to hike to, or so I've been told. Yeah, man. asithappens.tv. That's where I'm at.
Cool. I'm gonna go buy the soundtrack as soon as we're done with this. So
yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the soundtrack. I had no idea that was you. I guess I didn't even check the credits. So my bad.
The credits are very short, but yeah, the music. That's a. I'm not even gonna start talking about it. That's a whole other conversation.
Cool. Like one final question here. I want you to like be serious with me here. When you're eating trail mix, do you really give a shit about the raisins? Because I'm going for the M&Ms.
Oh man, trail mix. That makes me gag a little bit. Yeah, there's a few things I can't eat. Oatmeal, like the really traditional trail mix.
Oh,
and,
me too, man.
And I spent a lot of time in Mongolia last year, and I can't eat goat either, or mutton. But those are the three things: oatmeal, mutton, and trail mix. Can't do it.
All right. Well, yeah. Thanks for coming on, man. Thanks for the time, everyone. Please go check out As It Happens TV, Pacific Crest Trail. It's a great documentary. like I said, I watched it 3 times. I just really enjoyed it. So it's just great work, and please support what these guys are doing. So thanks, Andy. Thanks for coming on, and best luck to you in the future.
Thank you so much, Marty. Have a great night.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Our outro song is called Sombrero Lullaby and is by the Durango, Colorado singer-songwriter D.L. Marble. One of my best friends and biggest songwriting and musical influences, Matt Rupnow, is the guitarist in this band, and he plays a mean axe, and D.L. and the boys really know how to bring down the house. This song is off their first record called Not the One, which is available on iTunes as well as on www.dlmarblemusic.com. D.L. and his band, the Outlaw Seahorses, are currently in the studio working on their next record. Coming up on the next week's episode of the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour is author of China's Cosmological Prehistory, Laird Scranton. Laird has written many fantastic books such as Science of the Dogon and The Cosmological Origins of Myth and Symbol, and has been a huge influence for me. So stay tuned, and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks.
Somewhere I sold out what I believe, working for the man to earn my dime. Some people have told me it's my destiny. Sometimes I wish they could have asked me. Cause these songs keep calling on the radio. So far away. Somebody play me a sweet melody. We'll solve the world's problems some other day. These songs keep calling on the radio. When I've seen my name in the neon. Just me trying to escape the land of the free. And all I thought was right, it don't matter now. I need some time to relax and wash the blood from my hands. These songs keep calling on the radio. And I've seen my name.
You've been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathemagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com. And be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.